This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the programme today, we talk about cars, we talk about buses, we talk about trains, and we talk to and about politicians. Chris Conway fronts up. He's the head of TransLink, and he gives us his view on why there are now traffic issues in and around Grand Central Station, this shiny brand new station which opened a few weeks ago. When are the trains going to start coming to Grand Central, Chris? I ask him that question as well. I ask a lot of questions to a guy called Steve Baker. If you're a political anorak, you'll definitely remember him. Many others may too. He was the rebel of all rebels on the Tory back benches during the Brexit debates. He then became part of the establishment as such and became an NIO minister for 2 years before he lost his seat in July. We talked to Steve Baker, and speaking of politicians, I went for a swim with a Stormont minister and it didn't end well. Have a listen.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, happy Friday. It's the best day of the week in terms of traffic in Belfast anyway. Tuesday is now the busiest weekday. Friday is the quietest. But you've been telling us all week here on the Nolan Show how bad the traffic has been in the city this month since the brand new Grand Central Station opened.
I am so angry right now, it's hard to speak. Yes, I've been doing this for many years and it's worse than ever. I need to get home.
Worse than ever, really? Well, we're going to talk to TransLink in a minute, literally a minute. But there is a lot to talk about in terms of the big picture here, because the Nolan Show has seen figures which suggest that in the past decade, nothing much has changed in Belfast in spite of that big push. Remember Belfast on the Move to try to get us to use more public transport and leave our cars at home. Yes, if you look at the stats, the total number of people driving into the city centre in the past decade has gone down. That's a tick. That's a success. That's what Belfast on the Move was trying to do. But that may largely be due to more people now working from home since the COVID pandemic. We got actual raw numbers, some figures from the Department for Infrastructure for the period 2013 to 2023. And they showed there was no change in the percentage of people using their car. All those bus lanes, the glider, the cycle lanes, but no big difference. Let's talk this morning to the TransLink Chief Executive, Chris Conway. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
I take it you're well aware of those stats. Is that a failure?
No, well, I think the stats, if you take it back to 2011, show a 7% increase in public transport usage and about a 7% reduction in car usage. Obviously, we've had COVID in the middle of that as well, so we're, you know, there's an impact there that, you know, isn't the statistics don't actually give any account for. So we have to take that account as well. But it is fair to say that we have not made as much movement as we need to make in terms of the shift to public transport and to sustainable transport generally. I mean, this issue of car use and car dependency has been decades in the making, and it's going to take decades to fix to a certain extent. It's going to require significant changes in policy and demand management. I mean, the department's own Eastern Transport Plan very clearly says that we need to reduce unnecessary use of the private car by implementing effective demand management measures. And the reality is that, you know, we launched Glider in 2018, very, very successful. but we have not launched very many bus lanes or park and rides
yeah.
or taken any real big policy steps since 2018. And you know, we've launched, you know, Belfast Grand Central Station now, which is a great opportunity to seize the opportunities that that brings and to really make some change now going forward.
Just on that, the phone lines are lighting up. People want me to ask you the big question. Can you guess what it is?
I probably can't, Mark, but you better ask it.
So, when are the trains going to start?
So, Mark, what I can say and is that the construction is complete. The safety file is with the safety authority. We're working very closely with the safety authority now. I obviously, you know, everyone will want us to make sure that everything we do is safe. So it's important we go through that process with due diligence. But we hope that we'll be able to announce a date for opening very soon.
Construction is complete. Chris, you and I have done, I suppose, about 20 interviews so far this year. You've never said that to me before. That's progress.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about construction, I'm talking about the railway system.
You know, yeah.
Most people come in and see the station, but there's a railway system that sits in behind that. We have, you know, training going on that at the minute. So there are trains running on that network with staff to do training. And again, we're nearly complete on the training as well. So we're making really good progress, Mark. And as I said, I hope that we'll be able to announce something very soon in collaboration with the safety authority.
And I'll just ask you, just to narrow that down a little bit for me, what do you mean by very soon?
Mark, honestly, okay. It's not that I want to say more, it's that I can't really say more because we have to make sure the safety process is done properly
gotcha.
And diligently. You know,
gotcha. So. In a sense, it's out of your hands. It's with the safety authorities now, yeah?
Yeah, we'll be working closely with the safety authority. There's always a bit of, you know, to and fro on that process, but it's important that they have the time to do that process correctly.
Well, thanks for coming on. I know you don't have too much time, so let's go through the issues in terms of what's been coming up on our programme this week. I don't know if you've been listening. Hope you have. But some taxi drivers, some commuters are not happy about traffic disruption around your brand new shiny station.
Well, look, firstly, I would like to thank all of our passengers, our stakeholders, the local community, you know, for their patience and support during this time. We are constructing new Belfast Grand Central Station. It is a major piece of infrastructure. As I said, it's not just the station itself, it's the railway system behind that. It's all the public realm that we're doing around the station as well. This will be here for future generations, and it is about that modal shift that we need to see. And it is a long term. I mean, the station will be here for decades to come, and future generations will benefit from that. And there is some, I suppose, short-term disruption is inevitable as we go through that process. Now, what we've been doing is working very closely with DFI and the road service to make sure that anything we do on a temporary crossing basis, anything we do, you know, to ensure safe access for our passengers is properly managed. We'll continue to monitor that, take feedback and review our options as we go forward. And I suppose, you know, the wider issue really is that, you know, Belfast is a compact city.
Yeah.
It has got finite road space. And we know that congestion has been increasing over the years. And when, you know, anything happens in Belfast, it causes major disruption. And when we look at infrastructure investment, there is infrastructure investment coming for road surfacing, for water, for gas. There's been major infrastructure projects for gas, and they will continue over the period of time. So, you know, we've got to start as a society thinking, how do we best use our city? How do we best use the road space? We need to think about moving people, not cars.
I will come to that, but can you be honest with people? Because some of our transport experts, not that you wouldn't be honest, Chris, are saying things are actually going to get worse once you close Durham Street. That's the street that runs between the new station, behind Glengall Street and behind the Europa Hotel. Once you close that, probably traffic is going to get worse in that area.
Well, look, we're very honest about this. We have a programme which runs into 2025. There's quite a lot of public realm work to be done around the station. And as we know, Durham Street has to go through a major change, and that will require the closure of Durham Street, you know, later this year. Now, you know, as I said, we've put lots of temporary measures in place. We've put some additional temporary bus lanes up at Victoria Street to try and alleviate traffic there. And we've got lots of modelling going on as well to see how that will be impacted. So we will work very closely with stakeholders to try and manage that as best we can. But, you know, some disruption is inevitable. I you know, that's clear.
Speaking of stakeholders, Pat the taxi driver is on about drop on, dropping off, etc. What can you say to him? He's very unhappy about the Grosvenor Road and no lay-by as such to drop off. Eventually, will taxi drivers get a bespoke drop-off area?
Well, the future design does have drop-off zones for, you know, for people with disabilities, for taxis, for all of that, and that is in the design work. But, you know, we recognise in this temporary situation that, you know, there is some perhaps existing taxi drop-offs can be used with an extra walk for passengers. We have some drop-off zones at St Andrew's Square and at the Value Cabs entrance. They're fairly limited, but it's to give people who have specific needs to use those drop-off zones. But, yeah, look, we really are asking people to work with us. We appreciate some of the disruption that's happening. But we've got to remember this is a big infrastructure project in a fairly compact city. And you know, future generations will benefit from that. We will listen to feedback. We will continue to monitor the situation, and we will continue to review our options as we go forward.
People with disabilities are complaining quite a bit about this because, as you say, they can't be dropped off straight outside the station as things stand.
In the temporary situation, we've created a facility for people to be dropped off in St Andrew's Square and at the Value Cabs entrance. And, you know, we will make sure we make that as accessible for people from those areas. But it is a slightly longer distance than we would like it to be in the final stage. But again, we've worked very closely with IMTAC. In fact, I'm going to meet IMTAC, which is the Inclusive Mobility and Transport Advisory Committee. I'm going to meet them this next week, and with RNIB and Guide Dogs NI. And we will continue to work with them during this transitionary phases, take feedback and address any issues that we can.
Two last questions. Lower fares. If you really want people to use your buses and trains, bringing the prices down.
And I would really like to do that, Mark. That's a policy decision by government. And, you know, we would say that, you know, one of the concerns we have is that, you know, we have to try and make our service as sustainable as possible going forward. So there has to be some reasonable levels of fare increase. But it needs to be compatible with, for example, car parking charges and other measures as well. You know, there's a lot more we can do to make sure fares are equitable with other modes of transport. And I think we need to see more of that. Car parking charges have not gone up in Belfast for a decade, as I understand it. And we're working with employers as well. I mean, there's a lot of contract car parking goes on in Belfast. And we'd like employers to work with us, you know, do their bit as well, rather than maybe, you know, purchasing a car parking space for your employee. Think about an annual pass for public transport, for example, and that would help in terms of revenue as well. So there's lots of things we can do, Mark, to try and encourage more people to use public transport. A lot of the congestion you see is at peak times. So it's commuters. So it's people, employers, employees coming in. So we'd like employers to work with us to encourage more people to use public transport.
Speaking of, we got, and this is the final question because I know you have to go, the Department for Infrastructure gave us a statement. They said, they admitted that their figures show that trips into Belfast has remained practically constant following Belfast on the move in terms of the percentage, the proportion of cars. But you've hinted at this, Chris. They say further interventions would be required if we are to increase the level of trips made by sustainable modes. What do you interpret that as saying, further interventions? Is this just your new station, or is there more in the pipeline?
Well, I think the Eastern Transport 2035 vision is very clear. It says that we need to facilitate healthy and sustainable travel choices over unnecessary private car travel. And it has an objective to reduce unnecessary use of the private car by implementing effective demand management measures. So what does that mean? Certainly, there are areas where we would like to see more done. So, you know, bus lanes, bus passenger lanes, I would call them. This is about moving people more effectively. And certainly, there has not been a lot of implementation of those since Glider was introduced in 2018. More park and ride. Again, very little investment in park and ride over the last decade. As I've mentioned, some disincentives around car parking. And ultimately, you know, there are dozens of cities across the UK who have implemented clean air zones and seen the real benefits of that. I mean, you would not think of taking your car into London now because of some of the policies which they've implemented. So
congestion charge for Belfast?
Well, a clean air zone is I'd like to prefer to, okay. to talk about it. But there are other things we can do, before we get there. But I do think that there is, policies like that do need to be thought about.
Including more bus lanes and higher car park prices in Belfast.
Yeah, I think so. We need to encourage more people to use bus lanes or to use park and rides on the fringe of the city and then come in by public transport. And, I think we need to encourage that more. It's a lot of the big cities who have done it find there's real economic benefit to that as well, being able to move more freely around the city.
Chris Conway, thank you. We really appreciate it. We asked you to come on and you did come on, and you'll get back in touch with us. I know when those trains are going to start again from Belfast to Lisburn. It's been a long wait. But they are on time. You did always say that it would be autumn. We are in autumn. I heard it might be the middle of next month, if not before. But nobody's confirming that. Let's see. Mal O'Hara is the leader of the Green Party, with an obvious interest in this as well. And also the transport expert, Wesley Johnson, is a real expert in this. Wesley, what do you make of what Chris Conway's just had to say?
Yeah, Chris has done a good job of explaining some of the things. We have to differentiate between the two different projects that we're talking about here. There was Belfast on the Move, which was sort of 2012, 2013, and that's when we got all the bus lanes in the city centre. And that did change the makeup of vehicles in the city centre. We got numbers of private vehicles down from 57% to 50%. Bus travellers up from 20 to 23% as a result of that. Separately from that, then, we have Glider, which was introduced in 2028. and these figures show that the percentage of people driving to the city centre hasn't really changed as a result of that. So that's something that I think the planners would have felt disappointed in if they had known it. Now, it's slightly complicated by the fact that we had COVID in the middle of that, which put everything up the left. But nevertheless, what Chris was saying, I think, is correct. If you've introduced a glider and you're still finding no change in the percentage of people choosing to go into the city centre by car, then it suggests that there's something else needs done to attract people into that.
Yeah. Just on that, Wesley, in fairness to Chris Conway, he's being very candid there. He's not afraid. He's not shy about saying, we actually need more bus lanes. We need higher car park prices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the car parking charges is a sort of a stick approach. I'm more in favour of carrot approaches, to be honest. I think there's two things that would attract people onto buses more. One is to make it a more reliable journey choice. At the minute, there's one main park and ride on Glider, which is the one in Dundonald, but it's completely full. It's very successful, but it's completely full by 8:30 in the morning. So if you're arriving any time after that, you can't be sure you're going to get a space. And therefore, I know people who just wouldn't bother trying because they know they're not going to get a space. So making sure there's adequate park and ride at the city edge is one thing. And then reducing fares. Now, Chris can't do that himself because he's limited by what the department allows him to do.
So yeah, John O'Dowd, the minister. It's exactly. His call.
Exactly. But, you need to make public transport a much cheaper option. And that can only come from Stormont, and that's going to cost money as well. So it depends on, just whether there's the will there to do that.
I'm just thinking, Wesley, though, is it not an operational matter? Maybe the overall budget is John O'Dowd's responsibility and the executive's responsibility, but to TransLink not have a bit of wriggle room within there in terms of prices or not?
They would have a certain amount, but I don't think they would have enough wriggle room to make a significant difference to fare prices. That apart from government subsidies, that's their main other source of income. So if they halved fares, for example, that would create a huge budget black hole for them that would need to be filled. I think there's a third issue here, incidentally, which is in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had much increased move towards working from home. I think the whole concept of commuting is changing. Mm. 10 years ago, commuting into the city centre was just what a lot of people did. Now, I think it's not quite so certain that that's what the future necessarily holds. The idea of commuting into the city centre may be something that changes even more radically than it has in the next decade.
Interesting. Mal O'Hara is on the line. Good morning, Mal.
Good morning, Mark.
Have you any solutions? I suppose you like the idea of more bus lanes and higher car park prices in the big city.
I would first say that in terms of policy solutions, Mark, I think we are all quite disappointed in the programme for government that we've seen being brought forward by the executive parties in the last couple of weeks. They talk about expanding roads and airports in a climate emergency. They talk about consideration for the All-Ireland Rail Review, which will be a game-changer, Mark. I mean, the future has to be rail as well as getting people on the buses. There's no mention of buses. There's no mention of cycling. And I think that's symptomatic of decades of failure by the executive parties to really get people out of their private cars.
Mal, I looked at I had a look round the new station there and I saw those eight rail platforms. I have to confess, there was part of me wondering, Mal, why do we need eight rail platforms with so few railway lines?
Well, I think this is that why we need the All-Ireland Rail Review. I mean, I'm going to be responding to the programme for government and saying this should be a priority rather than expanding airports. Northern Ireland doesn't need three airports. But I think that's symptomatic of the executive being stuck in a roads first policy position, Mark. And I think I sent some information to your researchers yesterday. A previous executive consulted on a clean air strategy for Northern Ireland, and in that document they suggested that 1 in 24 deaths in the city are attributable to toxic air.
My goodness.
The air in the city is toxic. It is killing people, and it disproportionately is worse in inner city areas around the city core. And that's primarily because of transport emissions. That's people commuting in on private cars. So we need to do it for health reasons. We need to do it for climate reasons. It's a win-win if we move people out of their private cars.
Mal, you say we don't need three airports. Which one would you keep?
Well, I think we should actually work across the island and have a strategic review of airports all across the island. Do we need one major international hub on the island? Do we need some regional airports? Do we really need three in Northern Ireland for a population of less than 2 million?
Which one would you keep? Mal?
I wouldn't preempt a review, Mark. Okay. I think we should do a review rather than expanding airports. But I think the other thing here, Mark, is in Belfast, we are a rare anomaly. Most cities our size across all of Europe control local transport power. So that's about pedestrianisation, that's about your street lights, that's about your pedestrian crossings, that's about local transport. We don't.
Okay.
And as Greens, we brought a motion saying, let's start the discussion about that devolution of powers. Okay. And since then, the DUP shut it down, which I find is strange because in Dublin and in Cork, Sinn Féin councillors share transport powers with Green councillors, but not in Belfast.
I can't remember. I'm not going to doubt you. Well, I am doubting you. We just can't stand over that, Mal. We'll take your word for it, but we'll check it out. Mal, just while you're there, just one final thing. What do you think of the figures that we have revealed today about no real change in the proportion of car use in this city?
I think it's symptomatic of a failure of successive executive ministers. I mean, I would say to John O'Dowd, I dare you to be as brave as Eamon Ryan. When Eamon Ryan became transport minister in the Republic, he changed the spend from being two-thirds in favour of roads to being two-thirds in favour of public transport. That's led to two new rural bus routes per week over the last 2 years. So hundreds of new rural bus routes. That's led to a 20% reduction in fares. That's led to expansion of rail. That's led to expansion of cycling infrastructure. I would dare John O'Dowd and the executive to be as brave as Eamon Ryan.
Mal O'Hara, thank you. I'm going to give the final word to our transport expert, Wesley Johnson. Wesley, spell it out for punters, for commuters, for drivers, what we've heard today and what the next couple of months are going to look like in Belfast.
We're talking about the Grand Central Station. The hub that's been built is very much future-proofed. At the minute, the services are basically the same as we've had before. So this is sort of a step one. We are going to see Durham Street closed. That will affect traffic around that area. As Chris has said, it's a temporary problem. It will be difficult. But when all's said and done, it will leave a transport hub that can be expanded in the future. Now, your last contributors there said that, we need to be as brave as the South. It would be great if we could. We don't have as much money as the South, and that's where it always ends. It always ends with money. You know, we just don't have the money for what we either need or want up here.
And Wesley, just finally, are we being a little premature in judging this new station? because it doesn't really become a proper station until the trains start running.
Yes, that's right. You need to, when you introduce new infrastructure, you first of all need to let it be finished. And then secondly, you need to give it a period of several months to bed in before you can really judge how it's going to be. This was the case with, you know, Belfast on the Move. It was the case with the glider. You know, there was a lot of problems at the time. You know, there was those problems, you know, not that they've gone away, but they've settled down. You know, and I think that will happen in this case. So, you know, I would say to people, don't judge it until it's been up and running, finished for at least several months.
Wise words. That was Thought for the Day with Wesley Johnson. We're going to speak to Steve Baker after the 9:30 news. Unleashed, no longer having to ask Downing Street for permission to speak on the media. The former Conservative MP and minister here, Steve Baker, coming up next. Now, it seems a long time ago, but do you remember the last government and the NIO minister, Steve Baker? Yes, that's Steve Baker. The outspoken Brexiteer, the rebel of rebels on the back benches, who suddenly was on his best behaviour for 2 years in Belfast when he was promoted as a Minister of State to the NIO in 2022. Well, he's been speaking about this place, and it turns out he loved it here.
I've got a big heart for Northern Ireland. I hope you'll accept. I want Northern Ireland to really flourish. I think the people of Northern Ireland, whatever their view on the constitutional question, are overwhelmingly some of the warmest, most generous, most entrepreneurial, most admirable people I've met anywhere.
Well, that was Steve speaking on the Irish discussion programme, The Bike Shed, on Xspace. A great discussion. He talked for almost 2 hours. I'm delighted to say he's now on The Nolan Show. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
Steve Baker unleashed now. You didn't have to ask Downing Street or Chris Heaton Harris to come on.
Well, normally Chris would always encourage me to go on, of course. But no, in the past, of course, Downing Street very tightly controls what they call the grid. And it was very frustrating for Northern Ireland office officials, I hope they won't mind me saying, because we would plan things which we could do to participate in the discussion in Northern Ireland. And Number 10 would say no. So as you say, I'm unleashed, although you have made me laugh at the thought of me unleashed. goodness knows what I'll do.
Well, let's just fill in the blanks. You lost your seat, not by much, in Wickham. What are you doing now?
Well, I lost my seat because while Labour's vote fell, mine collapsed, and there wasn't much I could do about that. You know, getting on for half of Conservative voters at the last election either stayed at home or a small number voted for another party. Reform didn't do especially well, but it was kind of a big shrug of disillusionment with all political, with us in particular. But it is what it is. So what I'm going to do is assemble a portfolio of work in the private sector. It's coming together quite nicely, but I can't sort of announce any of it yet. But they're all things which I'll be proud of. Something's to do. One element of it, the main element, will be to do with reconciliation and helping people move beyond their disagreements in ways that are constructive. So obviously that's got relevance to Northern Ireland. But I'll be doing some work in power systems, I hope, shaking hands on that, and also another one in relation to helping a technology firm grow. So all sorts of things to do, some work on Bitcoin. So a portfolio of things I'm excited about.
How do you look back on your time at the NIO?
Well, I'm proud of it. I mean, it was an absolutely extraordinary time. I was appointed one day, and then the next, my first day in the office, Her Majesty the Queen died. That, of course, set in train some really historic events, and it was a genuine privilege and honour to be part of those events in Northern Ireland. You know, I shall never forget standing on the steps of Hillsborough Castle as the artillery pieces were fired. I shall never forget introducing Queen Camilla to Michelle O'Neill and others in Hillsborough Castle. You know, a particular privilege to do that. So the 25th anniversary, of course, the investment conference that we held, getting the executive back and finding a way for Northern Ireland to move on post-Brexit, as compromised as it is. You know, these were all big achievements, and I'm proud to have played my part.
Looking back, is there anything you would have done differently? I'm thinking of maybe the Windsor Framework, Casement Park, the Legacy Act.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, one of the things I would have loved to have done is be freer to actually govern within the parameters of the Northern Ireland office. The reality is government is a very complicated beast. So, for example, the first act I put through Parliament was in relation to identity and language. And that was put in train by a previous Secretary of State. So I turn up, you have to do it. Casement Park and other financial matters largely determined by the Treasury. So I'm afraid government's a very complicated beast. And when you're a minister, you accept collective responsibility. But I suppose, you know, particularly on the Windsor framework, I would have loved to have been one of those who actually negotiated it. Now, Rishi was very clear. He used all the many papers I'd written over the years about what to do in relation to Northern Ireland, but I was not in the room. And that was a source of the most immense frustration to me. And I nearly resigned over it, just the fact that I'd been excluded. And it was because I insisted that the Windsor framework was so central to Northern Ireland and the Northern Ireland office that I was given the opportunity to rise to the challenge of taking responsibility for its implementation by joining the Cabinet Office. So, well, I don't know, when you say about regrets, there's lots. I would have liked to have negotiated the Windsor framework, and I would have liked not to have left in place some EU law in part of the United Kingdom. But faced with what the Prime Minister of the day negotiated, I decided it was in Ireland's best interest that I should support it. And here we are, as compromised as it is.
So tell us more about that. At what point did you nearly walk away?
I nearly walked away when I discovered that the deal had almost been done and I hadn't been shown it. And I shouldn't get too into it because officials in the Northern Ireland office will have kittens. I don't want to overstress them. But there was a moment when it was clear that a deal had been done and I knew nothing of it. And as the Minister of State for the Northern Ireland office, I was incandescent that so much work on Northern Ireland should be done without so much as showing it to me. Unfortunately, government often works like that in moments of great tension. It's been typical of the whole Brexit process. I mean, it's what I resigned over when I was a Brexit minister, being excluded from the fundamental issues at stake. So, you know, I nearly resigned then, and I had to take very seriously whether I should resign the night before the Windsor framework was announced, and actually rang one of my closest associates and asked him, should I resign? And he said no, because would be to no purpose. But subsequently, he's not especially pleased that I've supported it. So it's all very complicated and emotional. But in the end, in politics, you must do what you think is best in all the circumstances. And I do think in all the circumstances, the alternative to the Windsor framework would have been for the UK as a whole to look like a clown show. I mean, not only the European Union, but the rest of the world would have come to believe that we were incapable of concluding any agreement.
And just to be absolutely clear, Steve, it was your exclusion from the process rather than the details of the Windsor framework which nearly led to your resignation.
No, two separate phases. So when I knew nothing of it, that was the process and my exclusion from it. And then when I actually knew the detail, I had to take seriously whether I would support it. So two separate circumstances in sequence. But I want to be really clear with people. As I've said, as a minister, on the record, at the dispatch box, the Windsor framework is a very hard compromise for unionists and Eurosceptics, including for me. I do not like leaving in place some EU law in part of the United Kingdom. I don't like the implications of it, in particular in relation to animal movements. I can see why unionists object. I object too. I'd like to do better. I've said so. But the only way to get to something better is to move forward with what's been agreed and show the world, including the European Union, that we're capable of respecting other people's legitimate interests while being resolute on our own. And that's what we now need to do and incrementally improve circumstances.
I was very struck by you taking part in that Irish discussion programme, The Bike Shed, and you were pressed very, very hard on your Brexiteer stance. But you've got to know the island a lot better, having lived here, by and large, for 2 years. Have you got a new perspective? Have you warmed to a united Ireland, perhaps, a bit more than previously as a staunch unionist?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, it's weird how some people have inferred that. What I want is great relations.
Sorry, you apologised to the Irish government, which I think Gareth Gordon was covering that at the Tory party conference a couple of years ago, and I think he nearly spat out his latte whenever he heard
that. Yeah, I sure did. Yes, and people often heard what they wanted to hear on that moment. I think if people go back and rewind the tape, as it were, what they hear me say is that I was sorry that we did not always behave in a way which persuaded the Irish government and the EU to understand that we respected their legitimate interests. And I do mean that, but I wasn't apologising for Brexit. I'm not sorry that we're out. What I regret and what I'm sorry for is the ridiculous process that we went through overall leaving Europe. It should have been done very differently. So one of the things I said on the Bike Shed podcast is citizens' rights should never have been put on the table. That created enormous ill feeling for individuals and internationally. Instead, what we should have said is, if you're a European citizen and you're here in the UK, you're very welcome. You'll be welcome to stay. We value the contribution you make to the life of the United Kingdom. And yet we've chosen to leave the EU, but we will guarantee your right to stay. Mm. We will put it into law, and we will expect the European Union to offer the same guarantees to United Kingdom citizens. It should have done that. It would have been the moral high ground, and it would have set us off on a quite a different path. But alas, I was not senior enough to insist upon that approach, and so it went.
One last question on Brexit. Do you think we'll ever go back into Europe?
No, I don't think they want us back. And actually, I've established very cordial relations, I don't think you'd mind me saying, with Ambassador Pedro Serrano, the current EU ambassador to the UK. I'm on great terms with a number of nation states ambassadors, partly because, as on your show, I think people know, if you ask me a question, I give you a straight answer. And I've always done that with the ambassadors throughout the whole process. And, you know, when I speak with them, they've been through enough and they've got their own problems. And they don't want to have another drama where they're talking about the United Kingdom and Brexit and reversing it. It's just they've moved on. We're out. It has been a bit like losing an arm and a leg for them, but they will not want us back. And I would say to anyone, look at what's going on in the European Union, the rise of political radicalism in a number of countries. That's what they need to deal with, because it's not working for the citizens of Europe. And they will not want to be wasting their time talking to us about going back, which would, by the way, include adopting the euro. And I just think it's a non-starter. We should pick our feet up, lift our heads up and go forward and make the best of where we are.
OK, you said you'll give a straight answer to a straight question. What do you think of our politicians now? You've got to know them a lot better.
I think that they mean very well, but that they're altogether too focused on the constitutional question. And you can see why, because you know, your listeners will know as well as me just how dearly people hold constitutional questions. We saw it in Brexit, and my goodness, we saw it to a worse extent in the Troubles and so forth. And it's a matter that needs to be taken extremely seriously. But it's 25 years on from the Belfast, 26 years on from the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. You know, it is time. It really is time to put first and foremost in the minds of every politician the ordinary, everyday needs of the people of Northern Ireland. That means fixing the health service, getting integration in education up beyond a paltry 8%. It means making sure the infrastructure is there so that companies can invest and make the most of the amazing people of Northern Ireland, their entrepreneurial skills. It means all those things which will lead to a flourishing Northern Ireland, and not getting up every morning working out how you can stick it to the other side on the constitutional question. That's got to stop. People have got to make Northern Ireland work.
And what about the NAO? What do you think of the Northern Ireland office, having been on the inside?
I'm big fans of officials there. They do their job with great diligence. And of course, they're criticised from both sides, as was I. I've been accused of being captured and all the rest of it. It's rather insulting. But the Northern Ireland office officials are really terrific people who care very, very much about Northern Ireland. Most of them. I'd have to go and put in an FOI request. But a good proportion of Northern Ireland office officials are from Northern Ireland. And a good proportion of them have Irish names with Irish spellings. You know, the officials in the Northern Ireland office care very passionately about Northern Ireland, and they go to work every day to do their level best for all the people of Northern Ireland, respecting the Good Friday Agreement. I'm not aware of any secret agendas. If they're secret, they've been kept from ministers and boards. They're trying to do the things which are set out in published documents, and they do a good job every day.
Are they not a bit aloof, Steve? I mean, I would love to have had this conversation with you this time last year, but there was no chance. Absolutely no chance.
Well, look, it's not the fault of Northern Ireland office officials. I'll be really plain with you. No, absolutely not. It's the fault, I'm afraid, of centralised communications, absolutely rigid grip on centralised communications on behalf of government by Number 10. And as a minister, I can tell you you ask your officials to arrange for you to go out on the Nolan show or whatever, and Number 10 says no because they're desperately afraid you'll disrupt the grid in GB. But the amazing thing about Northern Ireland is just how much can happen in Northern Ireland without it being reported in Great Britain. And that point, that argument was one I was never able to win. But look, I would have loved to come on your show and been on the media, you know, day after day throughout my 2 years. But I'm afraid number 10 says no. So, you know, it is a great frustration and regret that. But, you know, all the time people in Northern Ireland want me to come on the media, I'm sure I'll be able to say yes.
There you are. There you are. Hostage to fortune there. Speaking of number 10, Sue Gray, what do you make of what's going on there now? Very well known over here. And I'm sure you got to know her well, too.
I got to meet her occasionally, and I think we had a good and professional relationship. She's a consummate civil servant, but her political allegiances are obviously now very, very plain. She ruled over officials with an absolute rod of iron in relation to propriety. So it is ironic that number 10 is now embroiled with the various freebies for Keir Starmer and his wife. And you can tell it's... slightly amusing me that having accused us of chaos, it's now Labour chaos.
Well,
everywhere.
Speaking of, I don't know if you saw that the Prime Minister did a round of interviews yesterday. He did one with our own political editor, Enda McClafferty, and he asked him about, you know, the winter fuel payments, and he blamed it all on your government, the fact that this government is short of cash.
But look, any government...
A £22 billion black hole, unaccounted for under the last government. I can't walk past that. And the one thing that I think has hit pensioners in Northern Ireland harder than anything in recent years is when inflation got out of control. I'm not prepared to put them through that again.
That's all very well, Prime Minister, but do you know that some 80% of pensioners in Northern Ireland are going to be affected by this? Some of them have already told us that they're going to have to wear extra clothes this winter, and they're looking at you, a Prime Minister, who gets his suits paid for. Isn't that a bad look?
The promise I made to them and to everybody in Northern Ireland is that we'd take the necessary measures to stabilise the economy, to make sure the economy grows so everybody feels better off.
Why don't you buy your own suits? Some people are asking that question out there. Why does the Prime Minister need to get his wardrobe sponsored?
The important thing in all of this is that we follow the rules, which is really important to me, and make the declarations so that everything is transparent.
Everything is transparent. I suppose that's the difference, Steve, between Labour and the Conservative Party at Downing Street.
Well, everything's transparent for ministers and MPs anyway, because you're all required to make declarations. I mean, that's not changed. But what has changed here is that Labour have got a victory built on sand. As I mentioned earlier in the interview, you know, there wasn't a great enthusiasm for Labour in Wickham. Their vote fell. The number of people voting Labour in Wickham fell. Unfortunately, my vote collapsed. I respect that. It's for good reasons. But Labour have got a very broad but very shallow victory. And what they will be trying to do, I'm quite sure, is convert that victory into a much deeper one, and which makes them the natural party of government. To do that, they have to confront their reputation for fiscal irresponsibility. The only way they can do that is by having a row. The row they've chosen is a row of a winter fuel allowance. They obviously don't need to do it. Half the black hole they're talking about thereabouts is the pay decisions they've made themselves. And, you know, they're obviously doubling down into these rows when they've been called out, when they're squirming. The reason they're doing it is a thing I've seen many times. I've used it, I hope, honourably, a technique I've used honourably, I hope, myself several times. You have to have a row. You have to double down into it. The row they want is that is to make the case that they're fiscally responsible and we're not. And just as they're having the row with the TUC, I think it is, that they will continue to have this row to make their political case.
Well, there's a confession in there. What you would deliberately start a row over something?
Well, it's done. Yes, during the course of the Brexit process. I mean, it's when you're trying to get something done which is of the most immense importance and you face the most extreme opposition within the bounds of law, it is necessary to adopt certain political techniques to make sure that you advance. So, yes, there were times when we would make sure that we were having a row about a particular issue on which we could continue to double down, but always, if it was me doing it, on the moral high ground. Because the sort of thing which I worked against, where the technique was used, for example, was the bus. Everyone remembers the bus.
Yes.
There was a huge row about £350 million a week. So Dominic and others said they would change it. It came back with £50 million a day. And there was another row. So there, Dominic was using the technique. But Jacob Rees-Mogg and I complained about it. We went on the record with the Treasury Select Committee in a report which says it was wrong and should be changed. And that was a humiliation for Vote Leave during the course of the campaign because I was on the campaign committee. So I think I've got a strong record of doing what's morally defensible. But nevertheless, I'm afraid in politics, if you're not having a bit of edge, as in journalism, if there's not a bit of edge, it's not a story and you're not talking about it and you're not communicating your message. And this is what Labour are doing. They're trying to make themselves the party of government.
Steve, the more I listen to you, the more I'm shocked and surprised that you went into government. Was your natural home not as the rebel of rebels, the disruptor on the back benches?
Well, look, I got into politics because I was absolutely furious with the way it was being done. The way that the Constitution for Europe was rammed through as the Lisbon Treaty, positively against the express wishes of electors across Europe. And up to that point, I was a European federalist. But I was furious that the elites were willing to just stampede across voters' individuals' rights. Likewise, extraordinary rendition, the Iraq war.
I want to talk about you in your head, though, Steve, you know, for your own peace of mind. And we can talk about this. You've been very honest about your own mental health in the past decade or so. But what was it about you that you thought in 2022, I'm not going to be the outsider anymore. I'm going to become a minister.
There's a limit to what one can do as a rebel. By the time things get to a vote in a democratic assembly, it's really too late. I led campaigns on Brexit, on COVID, and on net zero, and I can tell all your listeners it's too late by the time it gets to a vote. That's why it's important people are members of political parties. That's why Lee Reynolds' article in The Critic about the structure of the DUP. Mm. That's why these things matter, because you have to solve the problems in politics well upstream, and not days or weeks or months in advance, but years in advance. And it's just very clear to me that it's necessary for people with strong views, and particularly strong views about the rights of ordinary people, that they should be government ministers. Because only that way, and I'm afraid only if you take your views and put them up on the shelf to be taken down later sometimes, only if one is willing to do that can one truly advance issues. But, you know, we're going to have a very long, we're going to spend the day on this show if we're not careful,
well,
which is deeply honouring, but probably not what your listeners want, if I may say.
Well, bear with me. I have a couple more questions. We do appreciate your time. Casement Park. What went wrong there? I mean, were you sat in meetings whereby people were dragging their heels? Were you not one of the voices saying, you know, this could be a game changer socially, politically, even financially in Northern Ireland ultimately?
The reality is, with the amount of business we had to get through in those 2 years, we didn't discuss Casement Park very much. By the time Casement Park was coming up on our agenda, it was because the costs had escalated beyond all reason. And I think it's just worth saying, you know, I remember 1 week where I had to make decisions on about £1 billion worth of money in total. And one of those decisions was to cancel three projects worth £75 million and redirect that money into the health service. And if you look at the state of the NHS in Northern Ireland, and if one accepts that resources are scarce, you have to start asking yourself, can you really spend £300 million plus on a stadium when actually the health service needs about that much and more to deliver the transformation that is so desperately needed for Northern Ireland? Northern Ireland is not going to flourish unless the problems of health waiting lists in Northern Ireland are dealt with.
I don't know if you ever saw my interview with your boss, Chris Heaton-Harris, when he said, we'll get the money, we'll get the money, don't you worry. Why did he say that to me?
Well, okay. I think he said it because he meant it. But as I've said earlier in the interview, you know, the machine's a very complicated one. The Treasury has its views and so forth. But, you know, Chris wouldn't mind me saying he is a real enthusiast for football. He's a football referee and he loves football. But I want to be honest with your listeners. With the fiscal circumstances we face, for me personally, I wouldn't spend a penny of taxpayers' money on people's recreations. People should pay for their own recreations. But that is considered a radical point of view. So, you know, as a minister, you pick up the policy as it is, and it would have been great to carry through the policy on Casement Park. It would have been wonderful. And obviously, it puts at risk having games in Northern Ireland, and that is highly undesirable. Okay. And as you say, for good social reasons, it'd be great to have those games in Northern Ireland. But now, the only way it's going to work is if UEFA come up with an exception and allow the game to be played. I'm so sorry, I can't remember the name of the stadium down the road, but, you know,
Windsor Park.
There's going to have to be an exception made.
You've been away too long, Steve. You've been away too long.
Well, indeed I have, but there we go.
I have two last questions, one political, one personal, and I promise I won't keep you after 10 o'clock. The political question is the Legacy Act. As a Conservative, believing in the rule of law, did that not stick in your craw?
Yes, I found it extremely difficult. And internally, I went to some trouble to satisfy myself that it was worthy of my support. It would be wrong of me to get into those details about the machinations of government. It's too soon since I've left office, and it wouldn't be fair on some quite senior officials. But I really held people to account. And as people will know that, you know, I did a lot of work on public interest immunity. So I've read a large amount of documents which have pertained to these events, none of which I can talk about. And I am satisfied that in all of the circumstances of Northern Ireland, and particularly in relation to past amnesties about firearms and so forth, early release of prisoners, I think it's not right for people to think that what's in the Legacy Act is in some way inconsistent with what has been proven to be necessary in Northern Ireland in the past. I think if people were consistent, they would, and if they recognised, however much our hearts may go out to families of victims, however much we may sympathise, however strongly we may believe in the rule of law, there's no realistic possibility of prosecutions now, and I think the Legacy Act was worthy of my support. And but it was a matter over which I put officials and indeed ministers to a great deal of trouble before I agreed to continue and support it.
You didn't nearly resign on that issue too?
I'm so sorry, your sound broke there.
You didn't nearly resign on that issue too?
I think everybody was afraid that I might, but I did not know. But it was mine. As you can tell, you know, I'm afraid I'm a man of strong views, my principle. And being a minister, unfortunately, does require you to surrender some of your own best ideas in order to abide by collective responsibility. But that is the system. And I hope you won't mind me saying that's why I've got a Substack on which I write about those issues now. And there's a lot to cover and a lot to say.
With a minute left, what next? Are you ruling out a return to Parliament?
I have ruled out a return to Parliament, yes. 14 years was a long time. I did my level best across a wide field. I tried to show the public that there were people of principle willing to take big risks and big hits, willing to put their rights ahead of their own career. And that's what I tried to do. That's what I think I tried to do. People may have disagreed with me, but I certainly can be seen to have taken big hits to do what I believed was right. And the result was a big shrug from the public, and half of the previous Conservative voters stayed at home. And I'm trying very hard not to say what I really think about that.
You'll have to come back on.
The people, you know, half the Tory voters of Wickham stayed at home. Well, okay. I mean, I'll really just say I hope they enjoy their Labour government.
And I'm going to finish with a really unfair question. Who's your favourite politician in Northern Ireland? Who's your favourite?
Well, I think that Gavin has done
Gavin
amazing
Robinson
things. But I also think I want to pay tribute to Emma. Emma is doing an absolutely superb job in the executive, and she really does have my admiration.
Steve Baker, we'll talk again. That was wonderful. Steve Baker, the former NIO minister, a current Stormont minister, went with me for a swim. More on that after the 10 o'clock news.
The news.
Now a story about a journalist and a Stormont minister and an interview in the Irish Sea, in the actual sea, with an unhappy ending. If you were listening to Tuesday's programme, you will have heard the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, invite me for a sea swim. He chose the venue, Ballygally, in East Antrim, for some reason. I agreed. The deal was, as long as I could bring a microphone and ask him some political questions once we got into the water. Anyway, we arranged to meet. I arrived first and found out there were lots of other swimmers there too, from a group. They call themselves the Ballygally Chili Dippers. It was a very eventful evening. Excuse me, I'm looking for Gordon Lyons, the minister from Stormont. Have you seen him anywhere?
The last time I saw him, he was in a board out there. He fell off it very elegantly. No, I'm telling a lie, he didn't. He fell off it, but not elegantly.
Well, I'm supposed to meet him here at 6 o'clock.
Somewhere on the sea, somewhere waiting for me.
We're in Ballygally.
Oh, here he is.
Oh, here he is. What do you think of him before I talk to him?
Okay, it's no bad spot.
Are you annoying my constituents?
So, Mr. Lyons, the last time...
I'm hoping that he checked the pollution for the water.
It's all sorted.
The last time I saw a Lyons near the beach was a Lyons Mane jellyfish that stung me in Helens Bay. No Lyons Manes here in East Antrim?
No, I hope not. We'll not see any today.
No. I've been every day. There's never been jellyfish here.
Never?
Well, this year there hasn't been any. Now, we do have weaver fish that do sting your feet.
Well, so I'm just about to go for a swim with the community's minister. I might ask him a few questions while I'm in. Have you any advice?
Just keep your head above the water.
Why did you recommend here? This is Ballygally, what, about 10, 15 minutes outside Larne? Why here?
It's only a few minutes drive from my house, first of all, so it's close by. It's where I normally come with friends and family to come down here. And as you see, whenever we get out, it's a fantastic view.
And you like swimming?
I do. I love it. It's easy to come down. It doesn't need to be open. You don't need anybody to open it up for you. And that's sometimes the problem with the pool or the leisure centre or gyms. You can come at any time, and it's great exercise.
You heard the ladies there talking about pollution levels. It's an issue. It's obviously not your department, it's Andrea Muir's department, but it's become quite a thing for people, particularly dippers in Loch Ness.
It has been, certainly, in Loch Ness, and I know in your part of the world. Thankfully, here, it hasn't been too bad. We've had a couple of occasions this summer where people have been advised not to go in, normally after heavy rainfall, but yeah, it's certainly an issue that we need to address. We have put forward plans as an executive to begin that work. I know it will take time, but this is a great example of why it is so important to do this, because decisions that we take will have an impact on whether or not people can enjoy what we have here in front of us.
I think it's swim time.
I think so.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me.
Right, we're in the water. One of the dippers here has just given us a tip on how not to feel cold.
Look at the sun. Keep looking at the sun and feel the heat.
It was then that the first ever interview in the Irish Sea with a Stormont minister was brought to a sudden end. Not by a press officer, not even by a jellyfish, but by a big wave and a dropped microphone. Oh dear.
And never again I'll go sailing. No more sailing. So long sailing.
Oh well, at least the swim was good. Big thanks to the Ballygally Chili Dippers who swim all year round, not just on sunny September evenings. I'll be back to see you soon. Thanks too to Gordon Lyons, and one of the things we had been hoping to talk about, as well as Casement Park, social housing, etc., was this Olympic celebration event to mark the achievements of our competitors in Paris last month. It's in 2 weeks' time in Belfast, Thursday the 3rd of October at the SSE Arena, and it's going to be hosted by Stephen, not Stephen Nolan, Stephen Watson. Stephen Nolan is back next week for all of you calling and texting. The main man is back at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. You have been calling about our top story, those traffic problems, which don't seem to be going away anytime soon in the centre of Belfast. Harry is on the line from West Tyrone. Harry, hello.
Hello, Mark.
What do you think?
Well, it was in particular at the Royal Hospital yesterday, and apparently it's every day, it's the same. Any time around visiting time, between 2:30 and 4:30, which is the visiting time of the Royal, it's near on impossible to get parked. We arrived yesterday, my wife and I. I had a hospital appointment myself at 2:45, and we arrived there roughly about 10 to 2. I thought we'd leave ourselves real good time to get in, and it was impossible. Whenever we pulled off at the motorway, at Broadway, we were met with the queue traffic. There could have been 100 cars in it, trying to get into one car park. We sat for a good 30 minutes, 40 minutes, before we realised we weren't going to get in time. At that point, my wife was driving, and she dropped me. We left the queue, and there were still, at that point, 40, 50 cars in front of me. And
that's all you need, Harry, in a day, that you're going to the hospital.
Yeah, and took me up around to the front door, which with no problems getting up around to the front door.
Okay.
There's no traffic all up around that, and dropped me off. She had to go back out then to the park centre and park out there and walk in.
Oh, dear.
To think that there could be 100 cars sitting waiting to get into a car park.
So that's...
waiting for one person to come out.
Harry, we'll see what we can find out about car parking at the Royal Victoria. Quick call from Gary in Castle Dawson before we move on. Gary, what's your point?
Mark, I just listened to you. Good morning, first of all.
And to you, Gary.
I just listened to you this morning, and everything's always about Belfast and public transport. Once you come out of Belfast, public transport is horrendous.
Yeah.
Do you know that you cannot get a bus from Derry till the airport without going to a private company? So if I wanted...
Which airport? The big airport?
The international one. I wanted to get a bus from Castle Dawson to the airport, I would have to go to the Europa, change over, and get a bus then from Belfast back until Antrim to the airport.
Right. Gary, we're going to have a look at that too. Very quick word from Gareth from Kirkcubbin. Hi, Gareth.
Oh, hello there, Mark. You were saying earlier on that the traffic volume is the same as it ever was, even after COVID. So that means that if we still had had more people working at offices and we hadn't had the COVID crisis, it would have been even busier now than what it was previously.
You're right and you're wrong, Gareth. We've had a really good deep dive. The team behind the scenes have had a really deep dive. It's the same proportion of cars coming in, around 50% of all traffic. But the numbers have gone down because more people are working from home. Thanks for contacting us. If you've got a story, you know how to get in touch. Phone us or email us. And that's how Cheryl got in touch with the programme. She lives, sadly, with a rare autoimmune condition which affects her liver. She's supposed to get a hospital checkup every 12 to 18 months. But she says 22 months have passed since her last appointment and she's worried. Nobody can tell her when she's going to get another appointment. I've been speaking to Cheryl and she began by telling me about her condition.
I have an autoimmune condition called primary biliary cholangitis, and it is your body attacks your own liver, and it can result in cirrhosis, and it, in extreme cases, it can result in you needing a liver transplant. So I would be seeing, it used to be 12 months, every 12 months, then it got extended out to every 18 months, and they do blood tests, and they just make sure I'm on the right medication and that nothing significant has changed. And that's really my condition.
And you've been seeking a review appointment?
Well, yes. So I had about maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, it suddenly popped into my head. I was like, do you know, I haven't actually had a letter yet from the hospital. I'll give them a ring and I'll see where they are with it. So when I rang girls on appointments, could just tell me I was on a waiting list. They couldn't give me any idea of when I could be seen because there was an issue with having someone to see me. So they put me through to the secretaries, and again they added a little bit more in. They said, you know, we had a consultant in post there for 2 weeks, and they left. Unfortunately, your consultant has gone already, so we really don't know when you're going to be seen. And that was what raised the red flag for me then. It was kind of like, yes, you obviously are on a waiting list and you don't mind waiting, but when there's no light at the end of the tunnel, it was quite disconcerting for me.
How do you feel about that?
Nervous, to be quite honest with you. Nervous, because when you have a condition like mine, they need to be on top of it all the time, you know, because there are symptoms that come and go, and you can get pangs of pain, and you know, so you're really quite aware that now you're left in limbo. Now you don't have anyone else to talk to, and they actually say to you, well, if your symptoms are bothersome, contact your GP. But you can do that, but your GP will transfer you back to them. So you're caught in this loop where your GP can refer you back in again, but you're still not going to be seen because there's no consultant in post.
Have you any idea when you may get to see a consultant?
No, none. And it'll be 2 weeks in November coming. 2 years, sorry, in November coming from I physically face-to-face seen a consultant.
And they're not able to give you any indication as to when you might get an appointment?
None. None. That was why I wanted to speak to the secretaries, and that's for the first time ever that's ever been said to me, that they have no indication because they just don't know. They must be having difficulty hiring consultants. There must be an issue there for whatever reason. That's something, you know, maybe you guys can find out, but there's something going on there.
We'll do our best. How long have you been struggling with this condition? How long have you been seeing a consultant at Craigavon?
Probably diagnosed about 23 years now. So it is a long time. And, you know, they've adjust meds, or they make sure that, you know, you're constantly reviewed. And that's what I'm missing. You know, it's the reassurance, I think. And most people will say the same if you're struggling with something like this. It's the reassurance of you've got a health professional who's experienced in this condition, and they can, you know, they can put your mind at rest if you're feeling anything different. And that's what I'm missing, and probably what a lot of people like me are missing at the moment.
And in this 20-odd years, has this ever happened before?
No. No.
And what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot I can do, because I can phone them again. And I am quite a persistent person. As people that know me know that I'm quite a persistent person. I will give them another month or two, and then I will ring them again, and I will ask, you know, do you have anyone now to see me? But I'm there's not a lot I can do other than pester par. That's really all we've got. You know, the only other thing is to see, well, you don't want to go down the route of paying a private consultant to tell you something that you're already paying into the National Health Service for. It's quite ridiculous.
Chair, that's, you know, what I was going to ask. Yeah. I mean, we've heard from a number of people over recent months, if not recent years. They feel as if, even though they may not have the money, they're forced to go down the private route.
Well, that's pretty much the way it is. I mean, I've had to do it in the past for other issues, where you've had to go and make your private appointment. But for this is an ongoing issue. This will be with me for as long as I live. This doesn't get any better. In fact, it gets worse. So I don't want to push myself into the private route, because I don't have health insurance, and I'm one of these people, unfortunately, that can't get health insurance. No one will touch me with a barge pole, you know. So you're caught in limbo there. It looks like I'm, and people like me, are having to pay the price for a health service that has been neglected for long enough, you know, and no one seems to be doing anything about it. The politicians are talking about it, but there's no change happening.
We have a new health minister, Mike Nesbitt. If he's listening, what's your message to him this morning?
The waiting lists. He needs to get a handle on the waiting list, and he needs to see what resources he needs to put in place quickly to get on top of this. And it might be an idea for him to actually, you know, they did a good job with the COVID vaccine rollout, because they pretty much handed it over to the health professionals, and they created and they did what they needed to do, and it was a relative success. So why don't they speak to the hospitals and the teams in there and say, what can you do, what can you suggest, and try and roll with it that way, because it needs something totally different needs to happen, because what they've been doing isn't working. They need to switch it up.
Cheryl, in terms of full disclosure, we know each other. You're Cheryl Grimason. I knew your late brothers, Daryl and Stephen. I was very interested in you describing yourself as a persistent person. You're a lot more than that, but your brothers, Stephen and Daryl, were too. We miss them. And you've gone through an awful lot, you and your family, in recent years.
We have. And the loss of the boys was huge for us. You know, two big figures, you know, in broadcasting and in political circles. And, you know, Daryl was, you know, he'll be coming up on 2 years gone now, and Stephen, we just lost him in April. So it's incredibly difficult, but I know, you know, I miss them, because Stephen would be the person that I'd be speaking to now and asking him, Stephen, what should I do? Where should I go? How can I get this issue addressed? And he would have been saying, oh, you need to do this, 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 and this. So I was forever grateful to know that, you know, I have yourself, Mark, who's going to hopefully pick up the baton and try and run with it to get some sort of resolution for me and probably thousands of other people in the same position.
Cheryl, we'll do our best for you. Give your mummy a big hug from me.
I will.
She's gone through an awful lot in recent years, but the grimaces are tough and we're thinking of you all.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks for this. Thank you.
Well, it was great to speak to Cheryl again, sadly under these circumstances, but we have a statement about her situation from the Southern Trust. They say, we absolutely acknowledge the stress that waiting for specialist support can cause patients and their families. We continue to prioritise and treat patients by the urgency and severity of their condition. We really encourage Cheryl to contact us directly so that we can discuss any concerns and advise her accordingly. Cheryl, if you're listening, that's for you. Okay, Cheryl brought us that story by email. She didn't use her BBC contacts, but she just emailed us. And so did John. John lives in an apartment block in Rathcoole, just outside Belfast. And he sent us some shocking pictures of lots of wires, big, thick electric wires hanging from the ceiling in his home. He's been trying to get them fixed and put behind the ceiling or behind the plaster, but it's not working. I spoke to John earlier and he described the problem himself.
Cables hanging down from the ducting. There's tape which the contractors put up. They used a black insulation tape to keep it up and it fell down within a half hour. And the next morning their supervisor came and put the duct tape up and it dropped. And it's been like that for 2 weeks.
So these are cables, electric cables on your roof that should be behind the plaster. Roughly how many cables are we talking about?
Maybe, say, 8 to 10 cables, you know, different ones. They're actually there's actually ducting along the ceiling.
Like, is it the sort of cables that if a kid came into your flat, they'd want to swing off them?
All the way, like, it's they're actually live cables, you know, neutral cables, earthen cables, you know. The sort of cables you would see inside a, you know, like a household plug, you know, when you're connecting the cables, you know, to a plug. They're just bare. That's it.
What's your problem with them, John?
Well, they said they would come back, and it's a bit complicated because they said told me that there was asbestos and they needed to change the whole ceiling.
Who's they? Because,
The contractors.
Okay.
And they said they would have to sort of way get it combined where the plaster or the joiner would come out at the same time as an electrician, but they seem to have problems getting them both out at the same time. They're not very good at organising, and I've just left with this here now for 2 weeks where they're hanging down and it's a sight. The tape's hanging down. I eventually had to get some connectors myself and I screwed them up into the wall.
How do you feel?
Apart from being a health and safety thing, it's just a sight. I have been trying to sort of like keep my wee place clean, as tidy as possible, painting and stuff. And with the water leak, which was bad, I did repaint it, but then they came out and done this. And it's just shambles. I mean, I don't think anybody in this day and age should live like this here.
Do you feel in danger?
Yes, because at the moment, say there was another leak, with all those cables hanging down, surely that must be a real danger, you know, to me. If there's water gets on these cables now, they're all bare in a way. Whereas when they were in the ducting, at least there was some protection for the cables, where there's absolutely none now.
I take it you've complained to the housing executive. What have they said?
Well, they have a sort of a portal. It's called the Northern Ireland Housing Executive. Like a customer portal. And as I said, it's been reported now since March, April. And all I can do is sort of phone them up and say, are they coming out? And they keep giving me times that they're coming out, but they never come out. For instance, the last two Fridays, they've sent a young apprentice out maybe about 6 o'clock in the evening on Friday, saying it would be out on a Monday. The last two Mondays, no one's came, and I'm just getting the runaround.
What about the contractor? Are you able to contact them directly?
No, no. I have to go through what they call... the housing executive has a sort of... I think it's called CSU. I've no idea what the CSU stands for, but it's a number that they give everybody that say they have any problems with a plumbing leak or whatever. They phone this number up, and the CSU organises the contractor or whoever it might be to come out and fix whatever the problem is.
John, you've sent in some of those pictures. I can see now what you're talking about. I'm not sure if I was you, I'd want to stay a minute in that flat.
Well, it's terrible. So there was one night I was actually going to the loo, and I heard a noise in the hallway. When I came out of my bedroom, there was a bunch of the cables just hanging down, and it scared the daylights out of me, because I was just scared to touch them, you know, because I'm not an electrician. I don't know what, if you touch them, are you going to get electrocuted or what, like, but it shouldn't be like that, especially after 2 weeks.
So they're hanging from the roof. They're in little bunches, different yes. colours of cables. These are the sorts of things that need to be behind plaster.
Yes.
How do you cope with that?
There's no point in me getting angry, because there's nothing I can do. And this is my last resort, getting in touch with the Nolan Show. And this is why I'm getting in touch with you, the sort of way trying get them to put them back up or do something.
And if the housing executive are listening, never mind any portal, what are you telling them directly over the BBC airwaves?
Could you please get these cables and put them back up where they should be?
John, just finally, I'm looking at these pictures again.
Yes.
It looks as if, sorry, on a lighter note, looks as if you've got a Doctor Who TARDIS in your flat as well.
Yes, it's a cardboard makeup. I like things like that. They're sort of like sci-fi-ish things and things like that there.
So it's a life-size cardboard Doctor Who TARDIS in your flat?
Yes, if it was a real thing, I'd go into it.
John, thank you. We'll see what we can do for you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Much obliged.
Oh, what a character John is. John, if you're listening, wait for it. We've got some very, very good news. It's all going to be fixed immediately. We got a statement from the housing executive. They were listening. They tell us a specialist electrician has now been engaged to complete the remedial work at the property. A new ceiling is going to be fitted once the electrical work has been carried out. And they wait for this. Here's the good news. We anticipate that the bulk of work necessary at this property will be complete by the end of this week. John, good news. So we've got a result for John. We're on it for Cheryl in terms of her waiting for an appointment, but we have nudged the Southern Trust for her. That's how sometimes we can help you. We'll always do our best. Keep in touch with us here at The Nolan Show. But that's it from me. Stephen is back next week. Normal service will be resumed. But I want to say one thing. A big thanks to all the team. There is no team that works harder at the BBC in Belfast than the people who work here on The Nolan Show. That's a fact. Trust me. Thanks to everyone who's phoned in this week too, and also for some very, very nice messages, and not just from my mum. But most of all, thanks to everyone at home or in their car, in their work or listening back on BBC Sounds. We can't do this show without you, and we really appreciate it. We don't take it for granted. We know you have other options. But that's it from me. In the meantime, don't go anywhere. Connor Phillips,
the biggest show
is next.
The country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.